Welcome to another episode of Repeak. We are a show about remakes, reboots, and revivals because nothing is original anymore. My name is Diana Olympia.
And I'm Stephanie Kim. Today, we'll be chatting about some of our favorite Cinderella retellings, the iconic TV movie featuring Brandy and Whitney Houston, a classic, and the beloved 90s iteration Ever After featuring Drew Barrymore. But first, this week was one hell of a news week. We are taping this on Monday, November 9th. The U.S. elections just, I guess, were wrapped now.
Projected to wrap.
Everybody in the country and the world were very invested in this particular election. Tuesday through Friday was a very anxiety-inducing experience. On Saturday, they declared that Joe Biden is the projected winner of this election and our president-elect, thank the fucking Lord. And I just wanted to get your feelings. You were a poll worker, you were very involved, and I need to hear how you feel now.
As you said, we were all kind of on pins and needles. Even though we knew it was going to be a long week, it still felt excruciatingly painful. I don't know where you were. I spent most of Friday somewhat glued in and out to cable news and then realized that that was a fool's errand. And then I slept in on Saturday because I was like, we're not finding out today. And then I found out because my boyfriend brought in the laptop and just quietly pointed to the screen. And I was kind of in shock for the first few hours, I'll be honest, because I feel like we've been waiting so long through these 4 years for this nightmare to be over. And granted, there is still a ton of work to be done. I do think this actually fits our podcast because this is Joe Biden, the remix, okay? Joe Biden was our vice president and now he is the president, right? And we are reviving democracy. We are reviving science. We are reviving truth.
Snaps to that.
We are going to remake America and we are going to reboot the White House with the first Black female vice president,
and Kamala South Harris. Asian.
You better believe South Asian American. Her mother immigrated from India. So I think it's just a beautiful remix of everything we've been through, and it's going to be a great rebuilding, lots to work on, but I'm very excited. I feel like we've been holding our breath for 4 years.
Yeah.
And Saturday was the first day I felt like in 4 years where I was able to like exhale. So I'm just extremely relieved, but obviously still pretty concerned about where we are as a country. There were still 70 million people who voted for the other side. And so I hope we can still keep the passion alive on all those other issues. But yeah, great start.
And as of this moment, the Orange Cheeto has not conceded. And I know we don't necessarily, it doesn't matter if he concedes or not. The Secret Service can boot him out as needed. However, it just concerns me. I've been kind of like keeping an eye on his Twitter I don't follow him on Twitter or anything, but I keep going back to his Twitter just to like check what he's saying and like checking the comments because some of his followers are so weird. It's like, if he doesn't concede, I just am afraid of something bad happening.
Totally.
How do you feel about that?
I think we even talked about this last time. I don't know if it was on the air or not, but it was definitely part of the anxiety I had coming into this election result, because either way, we knew there was going to be political unrest. We just weren't sure if it was going to be the left protesting or if it was going to be the right protesting the results. And I think a lot of pundits, that's what they were talking about immediately after they projected Biden the winner, is that so much of the fear is that what he 45 has done is he sowed the seeds of distrust in our democracy and in our institutions, and that regardless of whether or not he concedes or regardless of what happens, if his goal is to create chaos, it's happening. And I think that's definitely the part that I get, as you are, I think, referring to, like getting nervous about kind of what the fruit of that will be for years to come, right? Mm-hmm. There's still a lot of people in this country who basically voted for white supremacy.
Yep.
And the fact that they're so distrustful of what happened definitely is cause for concern. So that's why with every statement of joy that I say about the results of this election, it's definitely balanced by the fear that there's still a lot that we need to work on. So that's totally something that I'm cognizant of. I feel like I let myself have the weekend to kind of just celebrate. Mm-hmm. And then we need to really work hard on the Senate runoff in Georgia, because mm-hmm. that could be a huge game changer as well, as if we could get back the Senate. So you know, the work isn't done, but this is such a great start. And I'll say this, I was in shock, and I was messaging with you, I was messaging with other friends. Everyone was like, oh my God, I'm crying. Mm-hmm. And I was like, am I dead inside? I'm not crying. And then I was watching, I think it was MSNBC, and they played a clip of Joe Biden. He was addressing or meeting the parents of some of the Parkland kids. And there was a young boy who runs up to him and just hugs him. And I hope I don't cry again, because when I explained the clip to my boyfriend, I started crying. Aww. But he hugs Joe Biden, and Joe Biden looks down on him and says, hey, are you okay? And the boy says, no, I'm not. And Joe Biden just says, you're going to be okay. We're going to be okay. And I think it was just like the first moment in 4 years where there was like an authority figure at that level of the government saying like, hey, we're going to be okay. Mm-hmm. That's the moment that turned for me, because it just feels like, for the last 4 years, every time we wake up, we're not going to be okay. And we feel worse and worse because of what he's tweeting or what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And we just don't have to worry about that anymore. Like, he's not going to be perfect. He's not the perfect candidate. Nobody is. But just having that good old, like, Joe faith of, like, it's going to be okay. We're going to work together. We're going to figure this out. I feel like was just what I needed to hear. And so that was, like, the moment for me that, like, broke me. So
aww.
It definitely has given me hope.
I mean, this isn't a political podcast, and we won't turn this into one for this episode, but it's just been a very prevalent top of mind subject rolling into this week. And so I just wanted to get your thoughts. And to your point, it's relevant because this is Joe remixing America or reviving America or, you know, doing all the things he's supposed to be doing. I've seen actually a lot. I mean, not a lot, but I've seen a couple of headlines that have read, this is basically Obama's third term.
Right. Yeah.
and then I think just as a result of that, too, for some reason, I couldn't do this throughout these last 4 years because it made me too upset. I didn't watch the Becoming documentary on Netflix. I've made a point not to watch any Obama content, really. Not too much of it, at least, over the last 4 years. But this weekend, after they announced that Biden won, I just went down like a really big Obama rabbit hole on YouTube. And I like YouTubed all of his like interactions with kids, all of the Halloweens at the White House. And there's this one little clip of this kid, little baby toddler kid. He must be like 2. And he's wearing a Superman costume. I don't know if you've seen this. And then he spots Michelle and Barack Obama like down the hall, and they stop. The kid just like points and he goes, that's POTUS.
Aw, cute.
And it's so fucking cute. And then like Obama comes and like gives him a high five. And then when they high five, he like pretends to fall backwards. And then he's like, oh my God, so strong. You're so strong. And I'm just like.
He's so good with kids.
So good with kids. I miss them so much. And I just, I can't believe we went from like that elegant man to like this monster who can't even admit that he lost an election by 5 million votes. It's insane.
Yeah, totally agreed. I'll say 2 things. Number one, also we have dogs back in the White House. Very important footnote, just so everyone knows.
And our first rescue dog.
And our first rescue dog, yes. So we have 2 dogs back in the White House. And the other thing I'll say is that, like, we talked about doing Cinderella and Ever After before Election Day. We were both kind of, I think, feeling anxious about the upcoming week. It's a stretch. I'm going to try to make a connection here. But I will say that, you know, in both Ever After and in the Cinderella 97, we're looking at a not really nuanced look at good and evil here, right? There's like the good, honest, like dutiful Cinderella, and it's like the evil stepmother who just cares about power and prestige. So it does feel fitting for us to be covering it after the election, because that was kind of the theme of the election.
Yeah, at first I thought you were like doing a 180 because of all the horror I made you consume over the last month. And then I thought, really, how fitting and how fortuitous this was that you picked, you know, the most famous happily ever after story ever, right? when we're having this like great victory. And I feel like it was maybe a good luck charm for the election, because I do feel like all of a sudden I feel like good things can happen again.
It's possible, right? That's the song. Yeah, it's possible. so let's get into a little bit. So you just said, like, it, you know, maybe the most famous fairy tale of all time. Would you say this is maybe one of the most iterated stories of all time? I mean, there have literally been thousands of versions of this across languages, cultures. We're talking all the way back to like Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
I read something about 7 BC and AD 23 back in Greek, Greek mythology. Sorry, that's my rescue dog in the background. Being a very protective mini poodle who's very scary. But even, you know, Chinese stories. Do you think this is maybe the most repeated story?
You know, I can't really say for sure, but I think it's probably really high on the list, but I do have a confession to make, and this is going to be controversial.
Ooh, I love when you do confessions. Insert Usher's confession song right here.
Oh my God, I love that album.
That album is so good.
Burn on repeat. Ooh, it was so good. Oh my God, it's so good.
So good.
What a good album. One of the most iconic albums of the early 2000s.
Truly.
As an aside, but my confession is that I hate the Cinderella story.
Oh yeah.
I hate it. It's probably my least favorite fairy tale. Even when I was little, watching Disney animated version of Cinderella, it just felt like a punishment to me. And I just like don't know why, because like I was a girl who loved princesses and girly things and girly girls, but I was very much more into like The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, I guess those 90s ones, because the first Disney animated princess movie is Snow White. That's the very first one. And then there is Sleeping Beauty and Cinderella. But I've never really loved those three. Snow White, it's because it scares the shit out of me. Like, even now, there's just like that witch scares me to death. And Sleeping Beauty, I also didn't like Maleficent. And maybe it's just that I couldn't relate to like the blonde ladies specifically.
I hear that. I will just quickly interject and say Prince Philip was one of the hottest princes. Second to Prince Eric. Go on.
Oh, I always thought Eric was the best one.
Oh, Eric's number one. Philip is number two. That's my number two.
I don't even remember what Philip looks like. But yeah, I never liked the animated version of Cinderella. I loved this like Brandy version we're about to talk about now. And the music is delightful. And I remember like I recorded the Brandy Cinderella version. It was a TV special. So I recorded it when it was on ABC. You know, you'd have to do that thing where you would like press the record button when the show was airing, and then during the commercial breaks I would have to like stop it so that it didn't have the commercials in between, and then restart it. And then I'd watch that tape over and over and over again, and then I would like pretend to be Brandy in her little chair when she was doing that little cup number.
Yeah.
And I loved Ever After. I rewatched it last night, and what I found out is that the structure of the story itself really gives me like a ton of anxiety. The fact that her dad dies so early on, and that she's like stuck with these evil women that like hate her, and it's like just not anything that her dad would want her to be going through. And then it's like they treat her so poorly, and then she just like waits for this dude to come rescue her. I fucking hate it. It's the worst. So that's my confession.
Yeah, I don't think that's a hot take by any means. I actually kind of wanted to talk about why it's a story that's survived, and not just survived, but really thrived so much. If we talk about all the iterations of this, even in recent years, whether it's the Disney live action version in 2015 starring Lily James, even Enchanted, Ella Enchanted, a Cinderella story starring Hilary Duff, you take your pick.
Yeah.
They even actually took the 97 musical and brought it to Broadway. And within 6 months, it recouped its investment. And that was in like 2013, 2014. So this story is still very much resonates with people, I guess. And so I guess my question to you is, from coming from someone who, like me, I think I struggle with that structure similarly. But do you think it's just the rags to riches? Is it like it's just like the female glow up version of like the come up story? Or is it just women just like being a princess and being able to be plucked from anonymity into, I guess, wealth? I don't know. What do you think it is?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is very much the apex fairy tale story. This is like the archetype for everything else, right?
Yeah.
And I think it has to do with the class mobility and the fact that, you know, when you're poor, you just dream about becoming a rich person. And I guess in the olden days, you dreamed about having wealth and riches and security the same way people now dream about being famous and like getting that kind of attention. And it's also just the romance of it, the love at first sight aspect of it, because by the time Ever After ended last night when I was finishing watching it, I was like, oh, I love this particular one. And it's because they did a really good job of showing Drew Barrymore, who plays Cinderella, and her prince actually getting to know each other instead of just a first 5-minute meeting and the prince being like, I love you because you're the most beautiful person I've ever seen, and like really not knowing her at all. Like, I don't think she even like says anything in the animated version of Cinderella, does she? Like, I think her dialogue is very slim.
I don't know, but I had the same, the only gripe, if you could even call it one, with the Cinderella 97 one is less of it being about that specific adaptation and more about, like you were saying, the story structure. Mm-hmm. Because she's literally got 45 minutes because it's 11:15. We see the clock when Brandy arrives at the ball and she has until midnight. So she has 45 minutes to find the prince and make him fall in love with her, which is worse than The Bachelor. And that's a huge problem for me. So I completely agree. That's what makes... We can have a whole section talking about how Ever After was the most grounded and realistic version of Cinderella because they are... able to, as you say, get to know one another. They have like multiple essentially dates, whether she's herself, Danielle, or she's acting as the Comtesse. They have like a fucking amazing library date. And I will say that I am a sucker for princess stories with libraries because
me too.
That library in Beauty and the Beast is like my fucking like library goals dreams. I'll never have a house that big, but they do have like a somewhat mock version of that at Disneyland, and it's like very cool.
I was just about to say the library Beauty and the Beast is the library of my dreams. I was about to say that. It so is. And I want to do that thing with the when you,
with
when
the ladder?
You swing from the ladder like so much.
Did you watch either of the live action Cinderella or Beauty and the Beast? Starring our favorite American accent attempter.
I watched Beauty and the Beast, which is really good, actually. And I think she does fine. This is like the one role where I'm like, she's not that bad. She does fine.
Okay, but she sings. But she they make her sing.
It's not bad. It's not bad. And you know I'm very harsh on her. I did not watch the live action Cinderella, even though I love Lily James and Richard Madsen. But like, because I just like, I fucking hate the Cinderella story. I just didn't watch it.
Yeah.
But I hear... Richard Madsen's bulge is something to behold in that version.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. I love when the internet points out all the bulges in media. I don't know if you remember that John Hamm picture.
Oh, I don't remember.
Oh, it caused a whole scene on the internet.
Oh my God. So yeah, I have no feelings on the live action adaptation of Cinderella, but I really enjoyed Beauty and the Beast. I thought it was really well done. Which leads me into, I feel like they're starting to kind of scrape the bottom of the barrel a little bit on these live action remakes. The older ones are the more complicated ones. And I just keep thinking like, how the fuck are they going to do Little Mermaid?
I feel like live action things, no pun intended, but under the sea don't do well. What was the DC hero underwater?
Aquaman?
Yeah, Aquaman. Like, didn't it do terrible?
No, it did really well in the box office. It was just, like, not a good movie.
Did it?
Yeah, it did really well in the box office. It just wasn't
good. Good for Jason. Yeah. I love him. Okay. That's so funny because of how much Aquaman was panned within the Entourage universe. Did you watch the Little Mermaid live musical they did a couple years ago?
I didn't, no.
Yeah, I didn't either, but people seem to like it. I like, technically, I don't know how they're going to do it. Hopefully, like, just technology gets better and better and it doesn't look corny. But, you know, I'm just excited that they cast Halle as Little Mermaid, very much in kind of the vein of the Brandy casting. Hopefully, we see more of that.
Little Mermaid's actually my favorite one, even though it sends a really terrible message to little girls, and I don't condone that at all. But I just, I like the music, and I like Prince Eric, obviously, and I really relate to Ariel. So I'm just curious. I just don't know what it's going to look like. I can't, doesn't compute in my head, so I'm curious to see it.
Yeah, I don't know. They seem like they're pretty faithful when it comes to the live-action adaptation, so... On the one hand, I don't see them playing around with it too much, but I would hope they would, but I don't know. I just don't see them doing that. I mean, literally, Lion King was like shot for shot, basically. So if you can call that a live action. I wanted to ask you about chemistry, because that's another thing that I felt was endearing in Ever After, and which I actually didn't feel a lot in Cinderella with Brandy and Paolo Montalban. Shout out to Paolo Montalban, Filipino prince. I wanted to get your thoughts, because I'm not sure if it's just me, because I didn't feel the chemistry between them being Brandy and Paolo, but I thought it definitely worked in Ever After. There were like many palpable moments, and you could tell that there was like a flirtatious vibe, and especially as they got the chance to get to know each other, which I think definitely helped to that end. But what are your thoughts?
I completely agree. I went into Ever After, I remember really liking it when I was younger, like I said, but I wasn't ready to enjoy the experience. I was sort of like, oh, this feels like a chore, even though I remember liking the movie a lot. I think what really got me was watching Leonardo da Vinci in his boat shoes walking across the water. And I was like, yes, this is amazing. I love this movie. And then I agree that their chemistry is really endearing. And I loved all their dates. And I loved the way that they bickered. They got to know each other. It was just a really sweet relationship at the end of the day. And I 100% agree that Brandy and her prince did not have any chemistry. I think, okay, so I love Moesha. But I don't think Brandy is like the best actor.
Yeah, you can say it. It's fine.
And I love her Cinderella, and I love the colorblind casting, especially when I was little. It's so crazy because I remember like not thinking anything of it. The fact that she was black, and the fact that Whitney Houston was black, and the fact that Whoopi Goldberg and Victor Garber were married. At the end, I was like, Mom, there's a white Hanabaji, which is like a white grandpa, and Whoopi Goldberg, and they made an Asian baby. How is that possible? Like, I remember being like, what? But then I was like, okay, whatever. So that was really cool, obviously. But I do not think that cast as a whole was the best at acting. And I don't think that they were given the material to really harness that chemistry on film. I think the songs were great. The songs are really what make the movie stand out. It's not really their performances.
That's fair. And I don't know exactly how long they had to shoot, but it wasn't like a super extensive shoot for this. So I think that's a great point.
But I also just want to point out that this was very much like a movie of the week TV movie. It was like one of the biggest budgets that they've ever had for a TV movie. The bar is a little bit lower for a TV movie as opposed to a theatrical release.
Totally fair. This was not a feature film, so I think that also might lend itself to maybe a shorter shooting schedule. It probably might have only been as long as it was because of all the musical numbers and maybe studio recordings. But we're going to take a quick break, and we're definitely going to talk more about the music after the break.
And we're back.
So what's your favorite song from Cinderella 1997?
The one that I've been humming all week that I can't get out of my head is the 10 minutes ago I met you.
Oh, okay. Interesting. I did not expect you to pick that for some reason. Okay. What was your other one?
Really? I also love the in my own little corner, in my own little chair. Like I told you, I used to act that out when I was little in my room.
So cute. Oh, I wish I could get like a little VHS video of little Stephanie Kim singing that in her little corner. So cute.
Thank God that doesn't exist.
Technology. If Kanye West can create a hologram of Robert Kardashian, we can figure out some CGI way to do this of you. Maybe I'll get it for you for your 40th birthday.
Oh my God, please do not. Oh, so funny. But and then of course there's the Whitney Houston bop. Like that's just like the Impossible song is so great. And the fact that she's like, you just see her head kind of like bobbing out the window of the carriage while she's like riding to the castle for the ball is amazing. And then she just pops in and sits right next to Brandy. It's so good.
I have to say the graphics don't look horrible considering it was 1997. It definitely doesn't look like
bad at all.
Yeah, it's not state of the art, but like, you know, it hangs. Apparently she recorded that on some sort of like wooden carousel and then they like mashed it together. Also, apparently they ran out of money and like couldn't afford her overtime. So she is not physically present at the wedding. If you notice at the end, they had to like green screen her later. So there's that.
That's hilarious.
Did you read the oral history of this movie?
No, you have to tell me the highlights.
Shondaland did a great feature. I think it was back in 2017 for the 20th anniversary. So many good nuggets in them. One of them, this story about how they were doing ADRs and like redoing some of the dubs, the audio, and they needed Whitney to redo like just one note. And it's like a really hard note. It's like a high D or high C or something. I don't know. And so they're like, oh, do you need to warm up? She's like, no, I can just hit it. And then she just like does it. And she just like belts out this like one note perfectly. And everyone was just like, whoa. And she's like, yeah, I've always been able to do that just ever since I was little. I just open my mouth and it just comes out. Which is so funny because she's like so amazing, but like everybody in this oral history talked about how difficult she was, which is not like super surprising given it's Whitney Houston, but it's so interesting because on the one hand, she is the reason this musical happened, full stop. Mm-hmm. They aired Gypsy on CBS, I think maybe in like 93, and it did well. And the very next day, Whitney Houston's agent reached out to, I think, the producers and said, Whitney wants to do Cinderella. And a lot of people jumped on board to do this because of her, but then it languished in development because of her. They wrote the script. They like kept sending it to her house. She like either was too busy or just didn't want to deal with it. They literally had to put together a live reading and bring in a bunch of all-star Broadway people. They're literally reading it to her if she wouldn't read it herself. She didn't say anything the entire time. She was just reading the lines. And then at the end, she's like, oh, I love it. And keep in mind, this whole time, she was supposed to be Cinderella because they started talking in 1993. Then because she took so long, by the time it was ready, she's like, I've had a baby. I'm a mom now. I'm not Cinderella anymore. I don't feel like it's a fit anymore. And she is the one who recommended Brandy to take on Cinderella with her taking the fairy godmother role.
I love that.
And so she's an executive producer on the project. She had final creative control over everything, including casting. And she, along with the producers, were very much a big proponent of the colorblind casting because, in fact, one of the Disney executives, and he was kind of a rogue agent. This is not something the network or Michael Eisner were in support of, but there was one rogue male Disney executive who's like, let's have the black fairy godmother, but let's have Cinderella be white. And he wanted Jewel be Cinderella. Everyone shut that down. But suffice to say that Whitney was like very much the linchpin of this entire project. You and I were talking about is how hard it was to find. We were looking for the soundtrack. And so apparently the soundtrack was never released. And Whitney Houston herself said that it's her favorite project in her whole career, but it's also one of her biggest heartbreaks because the soundtrack never came out. And it was purely because of her and Brandy's labels. Like, they haven't had a problem with it, but apparently Brandy's label, Atlantic, they were so concerned about promoting Brandy as an urban artist, and they were worried that this would maybe be too confusing as like, which like doesn't make sense to me at all. But yeah, so those are some of like the good Whitney tidbits from it. It's a really great oral history. We'll post it in the show notes.
Executives are so stupid. I can't believe that's why we don't have the soundtrack anywhere. I was so upset because yeah, it's true. This whole, all of those songs are earworms, which obviously Rodgers and Hammerstein know what they're doing. But it was really annoying this week to have all these songs stuck in my head and to not be able to just go to Spotify and listen to them. And just knowing that it's a label executive's doing is infuriating. It's really upsetting.
Apparently somebody from the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization has been trying to talk to people about getting it out. So there might still be hope.
Do you think that that is because of the recent resurgence in interest for this particular reboot? The fact that it's very conspicuously missing from Disney Plus and that there's been a lot of coverage lately of that? Is that why people are re-interested in this again?
Potentially. And we should talk about that a little because Brandy, she at the time, she's 18. The year before, I think, is when Moesha started. The year before is also when she went with Kobe Bryant to his prom. Shout out to Kobe. RIP. Then the year after Cinderella, she does Never Say Never, which was like also one of her greatest albums. Then she does Full Moon in 2002. And then she kind of goes away. I don't know about you, but that was kind of the last that I thought of Brandy. Mm-hmm. And then this past August, her and Monica did a versus battle. And it was one of the most successful versus battles they've had so far. There was 1.2 million viewers on the Instagram live stream.
Wow.
And she just dropped a new album this year. So she's kind of come back, and she actually just did an all-ladies cypher at the BET Awards with her and Teyana Taylor and with Erykah Badu. So Brandy's kind of come back into the zeitgeist a little. Mm-hmm. And so to your point, I'm not sure if maybe there's some buzz. And obviously, musicals has kind of had an up and down success in pop culture relevance.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get your take on where you think that is now. But yeah, it's very possible that because Brandy's back in the zone and like everyone's now clamoring for this title on Disney Plus, that's part of it. But to that point about musicals, a really big moment in like the early mid-aughts with Chicago, also directed by Rob Marshall, who did the kind of musical direction for Cinderella title. You know, Rent came out, producers.
And Moulin Rouge,
right, which is also 2001, the year before. Then we have Les Mis in 2012. Then, you know, Into the Woods, again, Rob Marshall, 2014. Then we have a bunch of these TV live musicals that had varying degrees of success. But then we had Cats last year. So, like, we've kind of gone up and down. And we've also seen more of a resurgence in musical biopics, right? The Bohemian Rhapsodies of the world, The Rocket Man, mm-hmm. even A Star is Born. And kind of to your point, we don't really know how Little Mermaid is going to perform, or even Wicked. Wicked is another big one that's coming out soon. What's your take on where you feel like the pulse is right now? Are we kind of done with musicals again? Because there's been a lot, or are people still into it?
I don't really have a good handle on the zeitgeist per se, only because I personally have always and will always love musicals, even though I recognize that this is not a good movie and that P.T. Barnum is a monster. I really loved The Greatest Showman. I just love a cheesy musical. I love suspending that disbelief. I love watching people express themselves through song. I think that there is something about exposition through song that is so much more entertaining to watch than like exposition through regular dialogue. And I think that that was the big thing that was missing in Mulan. Because if you notice, in the animated version of Mulan, every time they were singing a song, that song was like doing a lot of exposition work. It was like doing a lot of work to move the plot forward. And because that was missing in the new live action adaptation, like we talked about, the live action adaptation just like dragged. I mean, I will always have a soft spot in my heart for musicals. I think a lot of the most beloved ones have been done and redone so much that maybe there isn't a ton of material now to go to, because I mean, I never really loved Les Mis. I never loved Cats, A Chorus Line, some of the like older ones that I'm just like not familiar with, but I loved Rent. I loved Wicked. I'm excited for the movie, but I'm a little bit trepidatious about how that's gonna go. I loved West Side Story, obviously. I think if I ever get married, like, I'm pretty sure that one of my wedding songs is going to be a song from West Side Story.
Ooh, yeah.
But I feel like people really aren't writing musicals anymore, original ones, unless you count Hamilton, obviously. But it's just such a big production to do that, to write an original new musical, that I can't really foresee that happening a lot moving forward.
Right. It's like a slow trickle as opposed to kind of like the bigger gushes and waterfalls that we've seen in past years. Because Dear Evan Hansen is an original musical that came out a few years ago, which was very successful and is being adapted to film version. Julianne Moore is slated to play one of the moms. I don't know. But that's like the biggest name that I've heard of. And then, of course, Mean Girls, which was a movie and then turned into a Broadway musical, is now being turned back into a film adaptation of the musical. So there's that.
What? I didn't know that.
Yeah, but then that's bringing in the cachet of the film. So there are some examples, but to your point, I feel like there's maybe less and less of those as originality is just, as we talk about, as the whole theme of the show is, becoming more rare, including in Broadway, perhaps. Or at least, let's say, to a scope of success, you know, as much in years past. Not to say there's no original musicals on Broadway anymore, but they're not at the level of the Wicked's, you mm-hmm. know, as much as they used to be.
And Wicked is in and of itself a retelling, obviously, of The Wizard of Oz.
True.
I will say I love Ben Platt, but I have no interest in watching Dear Evan Hansen because of what I've heard the plot is.
Oh, interesting. I watched it on Broadway with the original cast, and I liked it. I don't know.
I love Ben Platt so much, but just something about that, the fact that he's caught in a lie, right? And he just has to build on this lie throughout the entire musical. Is that correct?
Yes. And I will clarify to say that I'm not in support of the characters doing. I just really liked the music. And there were some of the songs just brought me to tears by the end of it. So...
Oh, I'm sure I would love the music. I just think that the entire premise is like anxiety inducing to me.
Agreed.
I think everything gives me anxiety. The fact that I don't like Cinderella because it makes me anxious because the stepmom's an evil bitch. And that's like the whole point. It's just like it says something. But I just hate waiting for people's lies to unravel. That entire plot structure really stresses me out. And I don't like it, even though I guess that was the plot structure of To All the Boys I've Loved Before. And that worked fine. But I think that's different.
It is a little different.
I don't know.
Okay, so 25th anniversary of this version of Cinderella is coming up in a couple of years. Are we done with it? One of the things that the producers said, and I think even Whitney Houston said herself, is that they wanted to do this because they said that every generation should have their own Cinderella. That's their take. Do you think this should be rebooted, this specific version? Or should Brandy and Whitney be the last version?
I mean, I love the Brandy and Whitney version, but I wouldn't be opposed to a reboot of this one. I think because it is a musical, it's already been redone. This version has already had 4 different iterations of productions on television and on Broadway. Because I think of it more like a Broadway show, and Broadway shows are known for, you know, revitalizing casts. Like, original cast members never stay on for more than like 2 years because it's such a grueling schedule and actors eventually want to do other things. And so you're just used to seeing different people doing the same roles. And I think because that's where my head is at, that's kind of where I put this musical. I wouldn't mind. It doesn't really feel the same as watching Legally Blonde replacing Reese Witherspoon. You know, like, it doesn't feel the same.
That makes sense. I get what you're saying. What would you want to see in a future remake, especially when it comes to the makeup and literally the demographic and who Cinderella is, right? Like, do we need to see a Latina Cinderella? Do we need to see an Asian Cinderella? There probably should be a queer take at some point, right? And I would love to see an Alice Wu Cinderella, right?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I would love to see a plus-size Cinderella.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I would love to see an Asian Cinderella. I'd love to see a Latinx Cinderella. I would love to see maybe even a trans Cinderella. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I would like to see the most, if they were to redo it, is just to develop the characters a little bit more. That's what I really liked about Ever After and what I was most surprised by, because even, you know, at the end of that movie, when Drew is like, I've only ever wanted one thing, and she's talking to Angelica Houston, her stepmother, and her stepmother was like, what was that? And it wasn't something frivolous like, I wanted to go to that ball, right? Which is like what Brandy is singing about this whole time, is like, all I've ever wanted is to go to this party, basically. And yeah. I'm just like, what? In the Drew Barrymore version, it's like, all I've ever wanted is the love of a mother. Have you ever loved me at all? And I just thought that was so moving, and it made sense. I wish they would give the characters a little bit more depth. I understand that it's a musical, and musicals are, unless you're Les Mis, and they're a little bit more light and fluffy, and they're meant to be fun. And so was this. It achieved its job in that sense, but I would really like to see more than 5 minutes of the prince and Cinderella getting to know each other. And also, I wanted to kind of see what else Cinderella cares about other than just getting a dress and going to this ball.
I completely agree with everything you just said. And just to build on some of those points, when you mentioned the plus size Cinderella, one of the things that I think Ever After does particularly well is that in the animated version, if I recall correctly, at least one or possibly both of the stepsisters, I think, are larger. And I think in general, the archetype of the stepsister is that she's like fat and ugly. Mm-hmm. She's mean, but she's also fat and ugly, right? I think I even wrote about this in like an essay in like a gender studies class in college, is that what Ever After does is more so point to, although there are like takes of Angelica Houston calling Jacqueline fat, even though she's not. So there's mm-hmm. still some element of fat shaming there. But the fact that it's more so that they're ugly because they're ugly on the inside, right? That's what really mm-hmm. makes them the ugly stepsisters, not that they're like physically unappealing. And so that's definitely something that I appreciated in Ever After. The second thing is that I totally agree with your point about the wish fulfillment, the dreamer aspect. There are some very Disney quotes in the Cinderella version, right? It's everything begins with a wish, dreaming instead of doing, which is like somewhat of a step further, but it's still very much the magical, I want the fairy godmother to come and help me thing, right?
Yeah.
In Ever After, Danielle is the rescuer of everybody. Mm-hmm. She rescues Maurice, the servant. She rescues the prince from the gypsies. She rescues herself from Pierre at the end. There is no one saving this girl except herself. I mean, Da Vinci literally frees her from the basement dungeon, attic, whatever, to go to the ball. And she has help getting ready. But she says, I belong to no one. She's very much her own woman. Mm-hmm. And that is probably the most important thing to me from that movie that makes it my favorite. And the other thing I'll say is that, to your point about the character development, another thing I appreciated about Ever After is that we actually get to know the prince more. Mm-hmm. They actually started out by having him be the rescuer, right? He's saving Da Vinci's painting. But then a few minutes later, we found out he's very snobbish and we kind of don't like him, right? Mm-hmm. And she is the one that kind of works on saving him from the inside too. But we see much more of his struggles and him feeling like he's not passionate about anything and not really wanting to be a royal and all this other stuff. And we kind of see a little bit of Paolo Montalban wanting to have not just a princess, but somebody he can talk to, but not really much else. This was the first time I remember actually like getting that side of the prince and then feeling at the end, and they say it a few times, like they are a match. They are a match to each other because we've been shown each of their individual wants and why they make sense together, not just one of them is rescuing the other. So I agree with you that I would love to see more development. They even developed the stepsister a little, right? Like Jacqueline has like a little bit of a storyline.
I love her.
Yeah. She has that little cute scene with her in like the horse costume.
Yes.
With so the guy. Cute. So I think that's definitely the level that we're looking for in the next one.
For sure. I want to talk a little bit more about the prince in the Rodgers and Hammerstein version and get your thoughts on what was the significance for you when you were younger watching a Filipino prince.
It was huge. I think the very first time I saw a promo, I was in disbelief because I was like, how did a Filipino not named Lea Salonga get into a Disney movie? She was the only one at the time that had broken through and was on television. And the fact that they made him the prince, I think this is definitely the antecedent to what we've been seeing in the last 5 years, which is seeing an Asian male as desirable. Mm-hmm. He was shirtless at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know that, but that he is ahead of his time there. And let me just say that Paolo Montalban walked so that Henry Golding could run. It needs to be said, okay? Also Manny Jacinto. But the boy can sing, okay? He was the last person to audition for this role. He was actually late to his audition, but then he sang and they're like, this is the guy. It totally meant the world to me. And seeing him again, he is so fine. And it just makes me so proud that he's in that role because he looks so good in all them suits. And not only having, you know, Black girls look up to Brandy and saying like, oh, I want to be that girl. But like maybe them saying, hey, I would like a guy like that, I think is really cool. And I think for it to have happened so long ago was definitely ahead of its time. And if you read the oral history, I think a lot of the cast was very cognizant of the broader impact that this was going to have. Jason Alexander talks about it. Victor Garber talks about it. Everybody in the cast definitely feels it now looking back. But I think maybe some of the older cast members were more self-aware about what that moment really was about back then. It's interesting. There's another tidbit in the oral history talking about how they were going to the VHS release. And they obviously were depending on the retail distributors, like the Walmarts of the world, to help them push this. And at the time, you know, it was really important to have those cardboard cutouts. And so they needed to send them like the Brandy Whitney Houston cutouts. And there was pushback. They were uncomfortable doing it. There was still this notion of, you know, having two Black women as the leads was not really seen as marketable. But guess what? Disney basically threatened them. Much props to them. They were very shrewd, as Disney is. They basically said, if you don't do this, we're not going to give you access to our animated films. And so they're like, okay, we'll do it. Guess how many units they sold in the first week?
A lot.
A million. They sold a million units in the first week. In 1997, that is out. That's insane. This thing had 60 million viewers at the time on television. This was originally written for television by Rodgers and Hammerstein back in like 1950-something. Julie Andrews was the first one who played it. Then they did a Leanne Warren version, I think in the 1960s. They used to air it annually on CBS as like a tradition. Mm-hmm. And they should 100% put this on ABC every year if they're not going to put it on Disney+.
Oh my God, please. Every year. Yeah, they do. It's a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving every year.
Yes,
why can't
exactly.
they do this every year?
Exactly. There's a lot of petitions out there. So if you guys are passionate about this, go to change.org and like Google what the petition is. But we should get this somewhere.
We should get this somewhere. Disney, come on. Give the people what they want. I'm sure they're aware.
You and I asked for Taylor Swift to do a folk record. So I feel like if we pray, if we say this loud enough, we can make this happen. You and I specifically.
For sure. For sure. We have the powers. Maybe we should take a break. But I do have a question related to the blind casting. Kind of a what if unanswerable one. But I'm just curious to get your thoughts. So we'll talk about that when we come back. And we're back. So we were just talking, lamenting more about why the Rodgers and Hammerstein version is not available legally anywhere.
It's weird because it's like Rodgers and Hammerstein's music. And so they have heirs and there's like an organization. Mm-hmm. But if the artists recorded it via permission through their labels, there might be some outstanding rights. You know, Whitney obviously is no longer with us. So maybe it's an estate thing. And, you know, distribution back then, maybe there weren't rights that people were thinking of at the time. Mm-hmm. And so there's a default that kind of just captures it and locks it in for some reason. But it's unacceptable because people will go to YouTube. Okay. People will do it the bad way. So just give it the legal way. You have a platform. You want people to come to your platform. People are dying for this. Just like people have been requesting black comedies from the 90s on Netflix. And that just happened. And people went bananas for mm-hmm. it. Twitter went nuts over it. It's a gold mine waiting to happen. And it's just to your point, there has to be some rights reason because I just don't see why they don't see the potential in it.
Yeah. I have two questions for you. The first one is, speaking of social media, I guess maybe because I was so young at the time when the Rodgers and Hammerstein TV movie came out and I wasn't really, I don't think, on the internet, I don't remember seeing any kind of press backlash for the casting being like it was. But remember a few years ago when some person joked that Donald Glover should be Spider-Man and then people freaked out because they thought yep. that it was actually going to happen? If we were to do something like this today and cast a Black Cinderella, I mean, I guess it happened with Little Mermaid and everybody was really excited, but do you think there would be a similar kind of pushback against it?
No, the main reason I'm saying that specifically in contrast to the Donald Glover example is, and you've said this yourself on this podcast, the comic book community in particular yeah. mm-hmm. is nefarious for being extremely particular about their IP, their property. They believe it should be, you know, they're all about canon. Canon is like, that's like a really big thing to them. I think as we've been talking about, there's just been so many iterations of this quote unquote IP. I feel like it's been done so much. It's just basically public domain at this point. Mm-hmm. And to your point, specifically as a musical, I think people are used to the idea of like a rotating cast, that I think there's less inclination to be protective and defensive about casting. And also to what you brought up, I think the Halle casting as Little Mermaid was a positive step in the right direction. Mm-hmm. So I would hope that there wouldn't be. But I think it is property specific.
Yeah.
That I don't think we would see this issue.
My other question, because we just went over my favorite songs and never went to yours. So what are your favorite songs?
I really only have one in terms of like what I think is the most re-listenable or like what to me is the most iconic song from the movie, which is The Impossible. It's the duet. It's great. And there's like a ton of U2s, which are like kind of famous by now, where it's like them in the studio and like Whitney's like trying to get the performance she wants out of Brandy. And I just think it's definitely the best bop. Original 1957 musical with Julie Andrews is actually available on YouTube through the Julie Andrews Organization. I'll Ooh. Link to it. We'll link to it in the show notes. And it's so funny watching the same songs in their original iteration. They are the same melodically, but they have been updated very, very well. And it's a credit to the music team in a very contemporary little bit of that R&B flavor that fit Whitney and Brandy so well. Brandy talks about how she was very, you know, nervous and intimidated by coming into this because to her, Broadway felt like opera. Mm-hmm. So they actually had to give her notes to almost exaggerate some of her diction, to almost do it as if it was opera. And then they had to give Paolo, who came from a Broadway background, to kind of loosen it up and be a little bit more poppy.
So they can like match each other.
Exactly. So they can match each other. So I think just the mechanics and the production team is really fascinating to read about, because I didn't know this. Not all the songs in this version came from the original. They actually, what they call, I guess, interpolated songs from other Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals to kind of fit the story. So Bernadette Peters' song is not an original Cinderella song. It's from a different musical, and it's Bernadette Peters. She's a Broadway legend. So they wanted to something that was, she's amazing, that was worthy of her voice and her performance. So there was a lot of work tweaking, combining songs, doing all sorts of things. And it just comes out seamlessly. Like you never would have known that they came from different musicals. I think everything flows really well together.
Agreed. I remember distinctly watching a version of a stage Cinderella, but I don't remember if it was Into the Woods or another version, but it was on TV and Bernadette Peters was in it. And it was a version, one of the oldest versions of Cinderella. The stepsisters cut off their heel and one of them cuts off one of their toes, and then another one cuts off their heel to fit in the shoe. Oh my God. And so I remember watching that. I think that's the Brothers Grimm version.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what's in that version, but I have just heard in general that it's definitely much darker and there's a lot more blood involved. So,
when did you first watch Ever After, and what were your feelings about it in the 90s when it came out?
I don't remember exactly where I watched it, but it was definitely in the 90s era. It was either like they showed it on TV or maybe like from Blockbuster rental or something, or maybe from the library. I remember liking it at the time, but it didn't really resonate with me necessarily as a favorite. And yet somehow it imbued a sense of nostalgia, because when we mentioned Ever After on our last episode, we both got really excited, like, oh my God, I love that movie. Mm-hmm. Even though like I didn't really have any specific memories about it. And I think at the time, I feel like I've always had a feminist streak, even from when I was very little. Susan B. Anthony, like, as soon as I learned about her, suddenly became the most important person to me, like, when I was 8.
I can totally see that being little Dio.
I had a gold like dollar coin that I got from like the Philadelphia Mint that I like kept in my closet for a really long time. And I remember, I feel like I was very, so I must have been like, what, 12 at the time when this came out. I feel like I was suspicious of the feminist angle because I don't know, like it just felt like a trap. But having rewatched a couple of the Cinderellas, like I briefly glanced through the 2015 version from Disney. I like kind of thought about the animated version, looked at the Julie Andrews one, far and away the best one when it comes to making her a strong, independent woman, a fully formed character who has desires and wants that are completely independent of the prince. There is a scene where she's in the field and she's like flying the kite. And Gustav, her best friend, is like, you know, you like him. Aren't you upset that he's going to get engaged? She's like, no, then they'll move out and go to the palace and I can just have my mother and father's home and work on it. And like, they won't be mean to my servant family, you know?
She's got her priorities straight.
Yeah, she's got her priorities. She's like got her own shit going on. You know what I mean? So when I was trying to poke holes this time around, I don't know about you, but I couldn't really find any. Maybe it's that she's too perfect and that she doesn't have enough multitudes as a human. But like, you know, she's bookish. She's also a tomboy, which I love. She's dirty as fuck when she like meets her stepmother, which is so funny. They have so many funny quotes at the beginning, like, don't eat the bones at dinner and give yourself away. She says like, oh, I slaughtered Gustav and like stuff like that, which is just so awesome. So yeah, upon second watch, like as an adult, I think it's my top adaptation and my top Cinderella, despite loving like the music and all that. But like from a character perspective, Danielle is my girl.
I would agree. And like I said before, I went into this rewatch not really expecting to love it as much as I did. But it really, by the end of it, I was like, wow, this version's really good and it really holds up. I do have a couple of gripes, but they're very superficial ones. Ooh,
I want them. I want them.
Drew Barrymore's accent is fucking terrible in this. And I think when I was younger, I even knew this. Because I remember being a little irked by it, but then I just kind of trusted, like, no, she's an actress. She's supposed to sound like this. But, like, no, I rewatched it and I was right. Even when I was little, her accent is terrible and I hate it. And that's like really the only bad thing I can say about this movie. This and my other gripe is that, you know, when they're in the date in the ruins where it's after she's been lashed and she is like trying to tell the prince something and he just keeps talking at her and she's clearly upset and like about to cry and he just keeps talking at her. He's not like, are you okay? Like, you don't look like yourself. What's going on? It's just like, there's just no sort of like room reading in this situation. And it really pisses me off.
He's a man in love, Stephanie.
Oh my God. It's so bad. So I think that those are like my two biggest gripes, but otherwise I loved this one and I loved it way more than I thought. And I dare I say, I think this is Drew Barrymore's apex. Like, I don't want to keep like ripping off okay. Our friends at The Ringer because we obviously love the rewatchables and all that, but I think it's her apex. I mean, she has a very long filmography, okay? But like, you know, she goes from E.T. to...
Charlie's Angels? Come on.
I know. The Charlie's Angels is what the other contender.
But that's more of a trio.
Yes. Charlie's Angels is definitely the other contender, but I think she is the prettiest here. She has the meatiest role. She has the most to do. Looks gorgeous. Like, at the end of the movie, during the ball scene, when she's all done up and she has the angel wings and she's saying, just breathe, I'm just like, fucking wow.
See, and this is always where they get caught up is like how they define apex, because you could make an argument for Wedding Singer or Never Been Kissed in terms of like, it's those are more like iconic. As much as I love Ever After, if we were playing like charades and the clue was Drew Barrymore, I wouldn't choose this film first as like the film clue. I would say Wedding Singer or Never Been Kissed.
But how would you play that out if you were playing charades? How would you play out Josie Grossi? And how would you play out The Wedding Singer?
The podcast people aren't going to see this, but I would do this. Like, that's me doing like no and kiss.
Okay. She did like an X across her arms, like, and then a no, like, lip thing.
And then an offensive Italian, like, kiss on the mouth. No, but like,
yeah, I feel like Michael Vartan. I know like we can't say anything during charades, that's the whole point. But like that's the only thing I could think of.
Okay, maybe apex in terms of like the year, because Wedding Singer is the same year and Never Been Kissed is right after, and then actually Charlie's Angels is the year after that. So
that's like a span of like 4 years where she's just churning out hit after hit after hit.
If you want to call it the Ever After era, I will buy into that argument.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that is an incredible four-year stretch. That is an incredible 4 years.
To your point about and this is the segue into favorite iconic scenes from the movie. I don't know why, because it's like not good, but I find it so like, I'm going to use the word endearing again, because it just fits for me. One of my favorite scenes is, I think it's their long date. It's the gypsy night, it's the tree and all that stuff, whatever. They're saying goodbye. And he asks her like, oh, will you meet me at the ruins tomorrow? And she says, I shall try. Like, I don't know why, but the delivery of that line has stuck with me for years. Like, if we were playing charades and you had Drew Barrymore as the clue and we could speak, I would want you to say, I shall try. And then I would know immediately the answer is Drew Barrymore. I don't know why, but I love that delivery. It's just so cute. And like, she doesn't have a lisp, but she kind of has that thing with her mouth. And it's just so cute. It's so cute. I love that. I love that scene.
Oh my God. I'm like dead. I'm dying.
What are some of your favorite scenes? I have more, but what are some of your favorite scenes?
Other than the ones I already mentioned, there's so many of them, man. I mean, I loved the Da Vinci boat shoes. And I think it's just because I didn't remember that Da Vinci was in this movie until I saw him walking across the water in those boat shoes. And I was like, oh, fuck, this is going to be awesome. I totally forgot about this. Oh, my God. At the end, at the wedding, when the Spanish princess is just crying. Like, it's so funny. And then when the stepsister who's in Up in the Air, the nice one, Jacqueline, I guess, when she goes back to Angelica Houston and she's like, I'm just here for the food.
Yeah, that's a good callback.
Amazing. So good. Those are probably my favorite. What are your favorites?
Okay, my number one favorite is she was in the tree. The gypsies have come back to fight the prince. She doesn't have her clothes because, well, she's like in her like pajama undergarment, like balloon thing, whatever. And she's demanding her dress back and a horse. And the gypsy's like, I give you my word, you can have whatever you can carry. And she kind of like takes a beat and she's like, do you promise? He says, yes. And she kind of like surveys the area. And then she walks up to the prince, takes one arm, puts it over hers, and then like just throws him on her back and starts. And they like, they let her like walk down with him. And like, it's like a hilarious scene of her. And he kind of just has this like, okay, I guess this is what's happening, which is also great. Like, he's not like, he's probably embarrassed, but like, he's fine with it. And she just like walks away with him. And like the gypsies like start cracking up like, nah, nah, okay, come back. I'll give you the horse. It's so funny. I love it so much. My other one is like when she shows up at the ball. I mean, it's an iconic scene in every Cinderella film. But that dress is beautiful. I mean, like, I mean, the fact that they sent this in like Renaissance France, and like the setting and like the costume design and everything is just like, it's just so beautiful and fun. It's a different take because we're so used to something magical. And I think this has its own kind of magic in a way. So that scene where she's in the wings that Da Vinci made for her, and she has that glittery eye makeup that was so hip back in the 90s.
Oh, so good.
Great scene. It's so good. My other two are just when Henry is like, this is at the end where they call the stepmother and the girls to the palace, and they're thinking, oh, he's about to propose to Marguerite. And Henry says, Marguerite, I don't believe you've met my wife. And then she like turns around.
Oh my God, so good.
It's such a good reveal. And I thought in particular, this is probably one of the most satisfying endings for the stepmother and stepsisters, because they really get like their justice. And you see them like fall into a pool of like purple dye. And then it's like the last scene where they kind of are poking fun a little bit at, you know, the fairy tale, because she's like, you're supposed to be charming. And he says, we're supposed to live happily ever after. And she's like, says who? And he's like, you know what? I don't know. I just love that. I know people really like the point is that they lived. I got to be honest, that never did anything for me. I don't really understand like the significance of that quote at the end. I prefer their last scene together. That's my other favorite. But when she picks up the prince is like by far my favorite.
Yeah, I have to admit, upon this most recent rewatch, I'm pretty sure I went to the bathroom during that scene and didn't pause. So I totally forgot that happened.
Go back and rewatch it. It's so funny.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it is so good. And I did think it was a really interesting choice, because I feel like in a lot of Cinderella's, the iconic scene at the end is their wedding, or it's their kiss at their wedding, right? And then I thought it was interesting that like they immediately for this one cut to them already being married. And it just like is a source of comfort for me. I'm like, nothing bad can happen at this point. It's like all already legal and like tucked away and done. Legal. Like they're already wiped up. Yeah, like they're wiped up and hubbied up together. And so Angelica Houston ain't getting in the way.
To that point, at first I thought the character was 16, but then she says 8 when her mother died, and then it's a 10-year jump, so she's actually 18. I thought that was also very important, because in so many of these fairy tales, especially in like the early animated ones, it's a very typical Hollywood thing where they look old, but they're actually like teenagers. And so the fact that there's all these like teenage brides in fairy tales, which is, I guess, more of the times like medieval and whatever, all that. I'm glad that they made that update.
I'm glad too. I also really liked that they, to your point earlier about how the stepsisters in this version weren't outwardly ugly. They were ugly because they were ugly on the inside. I actually really liked that the stepsisters in this one were pretty. I don't really like seeing doofy versions of the stepsisters. Like, I hate a Cinderella story, the Hilary Duff version, because like the two stepsisters are like, one's really tall and gangly, and I don't think that they're ugly, but I just don't really like the overly doofiness of it. You know, there's always like one really short and stout one, and there's always one really tall and like awkward one. It's very cartoonish, but like these women who played the stepsisters were both, in my opinion, gorgeous. And I feel like Jacqueline should have had a better career, because she's like one of those actresses that's like, oh, she's in that. She's like in so many things. Like, she's in Up in the Air, and she's in so many like other movies. but like she's never kind of broken out, and I feel bad for her.
It's a little bit of the Judy Greer effect, because she's kind of like the best friend, because she does this, and the director's Andrew Tennant. He also directs Sweet Home Alabama, and he casts her as the best friend with Reese, or like her childhood friend. But I want to make another point on what you said about like Marguerite, basically, because I think that also lends itself to the plot being more interesting, because and they do a good job of creating more tension in a lot of other ways. But one way they do it is that Marguerite is kind of a contender.
Yeah.
You kind of think that she's too much, but like he can't ignore the boobs.
Right.
In the tennis scene, he's like, oh, the brooch. And it's like, okay, let's. He still has like a dick. Okay.
What? This old thing?
Oh. What did she say? Like, you can look as much as you'd like or something like that.
Yeah.
The fact that there's that, so there's like the Spanish princess engagement. You know, he rejects her at the ball. She gets sold. There's a lot of like challenges and hurdles that they actually have to survive as individuals and as a couple. And I thought the scene where Angelica Houston basically says to her, it's your father's book or your mother's shoes, because Marguerite is about to burn the Utopia book if she doesn't hand over the mother's shoes that Marguerite wants to wear to the ball. That is fantastic. They've been able to use two physical items representing these very strong relationships and feelings that she has, forcing her to make a choice. And I thought that was really well done. Mm-hmm. Also, interestingly enough, like in most of the other, including in the 1997 version, we don't really ever talk about the mom and kind of what you were referring to earlier about her being in search of a mother's love. It's always about the dad, right? In the Brandy version, she cries to her father, and it's always about the father and the father and the father. Even in the 2015 version with Lily James, it's all about the father. But we don't really, in a lot of these Disney princesses, the mom is like always dead, and the girl never really seems to care for some reason. She just tries to replace that love by marrying a prince. So I thought it was interesting and much more fulsome to have that tension point of like her having her heart kind of empty because of her dad, but also because she never had a mother, and this is, she's trying to have one so badly, and no matter how poorly she's treated, she just still tries to please her. And I thought that made it much more interesting. Yeah.
It's heartbreaking. I agree. I thought that Drew Barrymore's relationship with Angelica Houston in Ever After was so well done. Angelica Houston also has glimpses of like, you kind of, she's cruel throughout, but then you can kind of see, I think it was like one scene of when Drew Barrymore was trying to brush her hair or something, where like she kind of, you can tell that she's thinking about being kind, and then she like pulls it back in, and then she says something evil. I just thought it was like so well done in that way. Their dynamic is very interesting. But that point that you just made about how all of the Disney princesses don't have moms reminds me of that scene from Wreck-It Ralph.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Ralph Breaks the Internet, where they're like, yeah.
In is that your room mother with all dead? The princes.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a great moment of self-awareness. God. All right, we are going to end with a rapid fire, because I just want to know quickly. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to pick one between the Cinderella 1997 and the Ever After, or I guess any iteration. So if you had to pick one, stepmother, Bernadette Peters or Angelica Houston?
Angelica Houston. Oh, that's so hard. I love Bernadette Peters, though.
Set of stepsisters.
Definitely Marguerite and Jacqueline.
Prince.
Paolo.
Cinderella.
Oh, I...
Yeah, this one's the hardest.
It's really hard. Drew. I think I have to go with Drew.
Yeah, my answers are all the same, except I think even though Angelica is a fantastic evil stepmother, I'm going to go with Bernadette Peters. She's so fun. I mean, they're both funny. Angelica Houston's thing with her spy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really funny too. But I just love Bernadette Peters, and like her whole scene with Jason Alexander at the ball is really funny.
But wait, are we going to do Leonardo da Vinci versus this?
Ooh, okay.
Godmother?
Yes. Who would you choose? Good question.
I think it's Whitney Houston.
Yeah, you got to do Whitney. She's fantastic. Yeah. I think that's also another interesting like decision that they made, to go the fraternal route, that it was more of a fairy godfather type deal. It was kind of a group effort, right, with the other servants and Gustav. But yeah, the fact that it was him giving her the wings instead of doing the traditional fairy godmother thing is interesting. One last thing, which I thought was hilarious, that it like kind of was like a running joke in Ever After, and which is, again, apt for our times up until Saturday, which was that being shipped to the Americas was a punishment, right? It's like, I'm going to ship you to the Americas. And it's like, oh, shit, I don't want to go to the Americas.
I don't want to go there. Barbaric, undeveloped land.
Which up until Saturday, yeah, felt appropriate because this place felt like somewhere I didn't want to be anymore. But I'm very glad that that is not the case anymore.
I am too. I'm glad. I'm proud to be an American again. Good for
I'm
us.
I'm proud to be an American. Isn't there like that country song?
No, 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 no. I was trying to hum it, but that doesn't work. But please follow us at Repeak Pod on Twitter and Instagram. Please subscribe. Please rate and give us a review. It really helps us out. And we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Love ya.
Bye.